You know that those who are born in illusion and grow up in illusion never recognize Maya for what it is. The whole world is Maya. All attachments are Maya. Death is Maya. All that you see and think is Maya. This life itself.
This is WGXC 90.7 FM, Accra, New York, welcoming you, the listeners, to our new community radio station. I invite you to listen to our Haitian Creole program, Lile Litan, every Sunday afternoon from 4 p.m. to 4:30 p.m. with your host, Pauline Murphy and Gregory Sanon, known as Azuke Legba. Two native Creole speakers who will bring you Haitian news, local happening, cultural music, and more. Restez branchés.
Hi, my name is Caitlin. You're listening to WGXC 90.7 FM, Accra, Catskill, Hudson. Hands-on listener-supported community radio.
Good morning once again to Grace Notes, the program in which we investigate from novelists and musicians, from philosophers and well-schooled sages, from illiterate laypeople and beloved poets, from scripture and holy books, from spiritual texts and channel tomes, the pathways to our higher selves. I ask you to just let the words and the music and the poetry wash over you, and if any of it resonates, let it sit in your heart and work its way into your core.
Ragged gabble of the Bear Garden School, as the women scratch and babble in Mrs. Organ Morgan's general shop, where everything is sold: custard, buckets, henna, rat trap, shrimp nets, sugar, stamps, confetti, paraffin, hatchets, whistles.
Mrs. Ogmore Pritchard.
La-di-da.
Got a man in both wells.
And he got a little telescope to look at birds.
Willy-nilly said.
Remember a first husband? He didn't need a telescope.
He looked at them in dressing through the keyhole.
And he used to shout, tally-ho!
But Mr. Ogmore was a proper gentleman.
Even though he hanged his collie.
Seen Mrs. Butcher Bynan.
She said Butcher Bynan put dogs in the mincer.
Go on, he's pulling her leg.
Now don't you dare tell her that, there's a dear.
Or she'll think he's trying to pull it off and eat it.
There's a nasty lot live here, when you come to think.
Look at that no-good boy you're now.
Too lazy to wipe his snout. And going out fishing every day, and all he ever brought back was a Mrs. Samuels.
Been in the water a week.
And look at Ockie Milkman's wife that nobody's ever seen.
He keeps her in the cupboard with the empties.
And think of dye bread with two wives.
One for the daytime and one for the night.
Men are brutes on the quiet. And how's Organ Morgan, Mrs. Morgan?
You look dead beat.
It's Organ all the time with him.
Up every night until midnight playing the organ.
Oh, I'm a master to music.
Outside, the sun springs down on the rough and tumbling town. It runs through the hedges of Guzgog Lane, cuffing the birds to sing. Spring whips green down Cockle Row, and the shells ring out. Clarigid, this snip of a morning, is wild fruit and warm, the streets, fields, sands and waters, springing in the young sun. Evans, the deaf, presses hard with black gloves on the coffin of his breast, in case his heart jumps out.
Where's your dignity? Lie down.
Spring stirs Gossamer Bynan's schoolmistress like a spoon.
Oh, what can I do? I'll never be refined if I twitch.
Spring, this strong morning, foams in a flame in Jack Black as he cobbles a high-heeled shoe for Mrs. Dyebred to the gypsy, but he hammers it sternly out.
There is no leg belonging to the foot that belongs to this shoe.
The sun and the green breeze ship Captain Cat's sea memory again.
No, I'll take the mulatto. By God, who's captain here? Parlez-vous jig-a-jig, madame?
Mary Ann Sailor says very softly to herself as she looks out at Llareggub Hill from the bedroom where she was born.
It is spring in Llareggyb, in the sun in my old age, and this is the chosen land.
And in willy-nilly the postman's dark and sizzling, damp, tea-coated, misty, pygmy kitchen, where the spitting cat kettles throb and hop on the range, Mrs. Willy-nilly steams open Mr. Mog Edwards' letter to Miss Mavanu Price and reads it aloud to Willy-nilly by the squint of the spring sun through the one sealed window running with tears, while the drugged, bedraggled hens at the back door whimper and snivel for the licorice bog-black tea.
From Manchester House, Llareggyb. Sole prop, Mr. Mog Edwards, late of Tush. Linen ripper, haberdasher, master tailor, costumer. For West End, negligee, linkery, tea gowns, evening dress, trousseaus, layettes. Also ready to wear for all occasions. Economical outfitting for agricultural employment, our speciality. Wardrobes bought. Among our satisfied customers, ministers of religion and JPs. Fittings by appointment. Advertising weekly in the Tush Bugle. Beloved Mavanu Price, my bride in heaven.
I love you until death do us part, and then we shall be together forever and ever. A new parcel of ribbons has come from Carmarthen today. All the colours in the rainbow. I wish I could tie a ribbon in your hair, a white one, but it cannot be. I dreamed last night you were all dripping wet, and you sat on my lap as the Reverend Jenkins went down the street. I see you got a mermaid in your lap, he said, and he lifted his hat. He's a proper Christian. Not like Cherry Owen, who said you should have thrown her back, he said. Business is very poorly. Polly Garter bought two garters with roses, but she never got stockings, so what is the use, I say? Mr. Waldo tried to sell me a woman's nightie outsize. He said he found it, and we know where. I sold a packet of pins to Sinbad Sailors to pick his teeth. If this goes on, I shall be in the poorhouse. My heart is in your bosom, and yours is in mine. God be with you always, Mavanu Price, and keep you lovely for me in his heavenly mansion. I must stop now and remain your eternal Mog Edwards.
And then a little message with a rubber stamp. Shop at Mog's.
And willy-nilly, rumbling, jockeys out again to the three-seated shack called the House of Commons in the back where the hens weep, and sees in sudden springshine herring gulls heckling down to the harbour where the fishermen spit and prop the morning up, and I, the fishy sea, smooth to the sea's end as it lulls in blue. Green and gold money, tobacco, tin salmon, hats with feathers, pots of fish paste, warmth for the winter to be, weave and leap in it rich and slippery in the flash and shapes of fishes through the cold sea streets. But with blue, lazy eyes, the fishermen gaze at that milkmaid whispering water with no ruck or ripple, as though it blew great guns and serpents and typhooned the town.
Too rough for fishing today.
And they thank God and gob at a gull for luck. And moss slow and silent make their way uphill from the still, still sea towards the sailors' arms as the children spank and scamper rough and singing out of school into the draggletail yard. And Captain Cat at his window says soft to himself the words of their song.
Happy snail, let the baby in the milking pail. Happy snail
and Johnny Crack, one will pull it out. And one will put it back. Oh, it's my turn now, said Saucy Snail, to take the baby from the milking pail. And it's my turn now, said Johnny Crack, to smack it on the head and put it back. Johnny Crack and Saucy Snail kept their baby in a milking pail. One will put it back and one will pull it out. And all it had to drink was ale and stout for Johnny Crack. I'm crossing.
I imagine Jesus sitting on my shoulder, like a leprechaun or a tumor, benign but insistent, surveying together the unending expressions of love, lust, and larceny, the infinite circus acts of man. He silently mouths wisdom and altered perspectives into my ear. Rewatching the puppetry with borrowed eyes, I chuckle with disinterest and brotherly unconcern. All rivers to the ocean, all hands to the deck. The arc of the inevitable, as always, sails at dawn. I'd like now to continue where we left off last time from the text of A Course in Miracles. This chapter is called Atonement and Miracles. I am in charge of the process of atonement, which I undertook to begin. When you offer a miracle to any of my brothers, you do it to yourself and me. The reason you come before me is that I do not need miracles for my own atonement, but I stand at the end in case you fail temporarily. My part in the atonement is the cancelling out of all errors that you could not otherwise correct. When you have been restored to the recognition of your original state, you naturally become part of the atonement yourself. As you share my unwillingness to accept error in yourself and others, you must join the great crusade to correct it. Listen to my voice, learn to undo error, and correct it. The power to work miracles belongs to you. I will provide the opportunities to do them, but you must be ready and willing. Doing them will bring conviction in the ability, because conviction comes through accomplishment. The ability is the potential, the achievement is its expression, and the atonement, which is the natural profession of the children of God, is its purpose. Heaven and earth shall pass away means that they will not continue to exist as separate states. My word, which is the resurrection and the life, shall not pass away, because life is eternal. You are the work of God, and his work is wholly lovable and wholly loving. This is how a man must think of himself in his heart, because this is what he is. The forgiven are the means of the atonement. Being filled with spirit, they forgive in return. Those who are released must join in releasing their brothers, for this is the plan of the atonement. Miracles are the way in which minds that serve the Holy Spirit unite with me for the salvation or release of all of God's creatures. I am the only one who can perform miracles indiscriminately, because I am the atonement. You have a role in the atonement which I will dictate to you. Ask me what miracles you should perform. This spurs your needless effort, because you will be acting under direct communication. The impersonal nature of the miracle is an essential ingredient, because it enables me to direct its application. And under my guidance, miracles lead to a highly personal experience of revelation. A guide does not control, but he does direct, leaving it up to you to follow. Lead us not into temptation means recognize your errors and choose to abandon them by following my guidance. Error cannot really threaten truth, which can always withstand it. Only the error is actually vulnerable. You are free to establish your kingdom where you see fit, but the right choice is inevitable if you remember this. Spirit is in a state of grace forever. Your reality is only spirit, therefore you are in a state of grace forever. Atonement undoes all errors in this respect, and thus uproots the source of fear. Whenever you experience God's reassurances as threat, it is always because you are defending misplaced or misdirected loyalty. When you project this to others, you imprison them, but only to the extent to which you reinforce errors they have already made. This makes them vulnerable to the distortions of others, since their own perception of themselves is distorted. The miracle worker can only bless them, and this undoes their distortions and frees them from prison. You respond to what you perceive, and as you perceive, so shall you behave. The golden rule asks you to do unto others as you would have them do unto you. This means that the perception of both must be accurate. The golden rule is the rule for appropriate behavior. You cannot behave appropriately unless you perceive correctly. Since you and your neighbor are equal members of one family, as you perceive both, so you will do to both. You should look out from the perception of your own holiness to the holiness of others. Miracles arise from a mind that is ready for them. By being united, this mind goes out to everyone, even without the awareness of the miracle worker himself. The impersonal nature of miracles is because the atonement itself is one, uniting all creations with their creator. As an expression of what you truly are, the miracle places the mind in a state of grace. The mind then naturally becomes and welcomes the host within and the stranger without. When you bring in the stranger, he becomes your brother. That the miracle may have effects on your brothers that you may not recognize is not your concern. The miracle will always bless you. Miracles you are not asked to perform have not lost their value. They are still expressions of your own state of grace. But the action aspects of the miracle should be controlled by me because of my complete awareness of the whole plan. The impersonal nature of miracle-mindedness ensures your grace, but only I am in a position to know where they can be bestowed. Miracles are selective only in the sense that they are directed towards those who can use them for themselves. Since this makes it inevitable that they will extend them to others, a strong chain of atonement is welded. However, this selectively takes no account of the magnitude of the miracle itself, because the concept of size exists on a plane that is itself unreal. Since the miracle aims at restoring the awareness of reality, it would not be useful if it were bound by laws that govern the error it aims to correct.
Afterwards, he says, they always embrace. The animal digs his sweaty brow into his cheek, and they stand in the dark for an hour, like a necking couple. And of all nonsensical things, I keep thinking about the horse. Not the boy, the horse, and what he might be trying to do. I keep seeing the huge head kissing him with its chained mouth, nudging through the metal some desire absolutely irrelevant to filling its belly or propagating its own kind. What desire could this be? Not to stay a horse any longer. Not to remain reined up forever in those particular genetic strings. Is it possible at certain moments we cannot imagine a horse can add its sufferings together, the non-stop jerks and jabs that are its daily life, and turn them into grief? What use is grief? to a horse. You see, I'm lost. What use I should be asking questions like these to an overworked psychiatrist in a provincial hospital? They're worse than useless. They are, in fact, subversive. The thing is, I'm wearing that horse's head myself, all reined up in old language and old assumptions, straining to jump clean-hooved onto a whole new track of being I only suspect is there. I can't see it because my educated average head is being held at the wrong angle. I can't jump because the bit forbids it, and my own basic force, my horsepower, if you like, is too little. The only thing I know for sure is this. A horse's head is finally unknowable to me. Yet I handle children's heads, which I must presume to be more complicated, at least in the area of my chief concern. In a way, it has nothing to do with this boy. The doubts have been there for years, piling up steadily in this dreary place. It's only the extremity of this case that's made them active. I know that the extremity is the point. All the same, whatever the reasons, these doubts are now not just vaguely worrying, but intolerable. Forgive me. I'm not making much sense. Let me start properly, in order.
Can you coax your mind from its wandering and keep to the original oneness? Can you let your body become supple as a newborn child's? Can you cleanse your inner vision until you see nothing but the light? Can you love people and lead them without imposing your will? Can you deal with the most vital matters by letting events take their course? Can you step back from your own mind and thus understand all things? Giving birth and nourishing, having without possessing, acting with no expectations, leading and not trying to take control. This is supreme virtue. That's chapter 10 from the Tao Te Ching, translated by Stephen Mitchell.
No!
Perhaps all this is getting near the heart of Englishness. Being unhappy, rather than doing something constructive about it. We boast of our genius for compromise, which is really a refusal to choose. And that in turn contains a large part of cowardice, apathy, selfish laziness. But it is also, I grow increasingly certain of this as I grow older, a function of our peculiar imagination, of our racial and individual gift for metaphor, for allowing hypotheses about ourselves and our pasts and futures almost as much reality as the true events and destinies. Other races look at themselves in the mirror and either live with the reflection or do something practical to improve it. We paint an ideal or a dream self on the glass and then wallow in the discrepancy. Nothing distinguishes us more clearly from the Americans. Nothing characterizes better the very different ways we use our shared language, the way they use it as a tool even when they are being poetic, and the way we treat it as a poem even when we are using it as a tool. And it is the same with the enormous semantic subtleties of middle-class English intonation and the poverty of nuance in even the most intellectually sophisticated American equivalent. These two dialects seem to me two reactions to the same thing, the craving for freedom. The American myth is of free will in its simple primary sense. One can choose oneself and will oneself, and this absurdly optimistic assumption so dominates the Republic that it has bred all of its gross social injustices. Failure to succeed proves a moral, not a genetic fault. All men are born equal becomes no decent society can help those who fail to stay equal. The myth becomes so pervasive that it even ends up as the credo of those, the underprivileged, who most need to disbelieve it. I have seen it in even the most intelligent liberals there, people like Abe and Mildred, impeccably sympathetic in their attitude to things like Medicare, black anger, environmental control, and all the rest. Yet still they hanker after the old and other American dream of freedom to cash in on other people's inequality. From the beginning, Americans came to America to escape two things: political tyranny and fixed odds in the struggle for life. And they have never realized that the two aims are profoundly hostile to each other. That the genetic injustice of life is just as great as the European economic injustice. Their system dealt with the latter by assuming an equal dispensation of energy, talent, and good luck to all men, and now they're smashed hard on the reef of the far deeper injustice. All this was, of course, also the English assumption in the 16th and 17th centuries, but we have long abandoned it. Injustice and inequality are in the nature of things like Virgil's tears, and we have extrapolated freedom from all living reality. It is a thing in the mind, a utopia we secretly retreat to from our daily ordinary world. Just as I have always lived far more in the mind at Thorncombe than in reality. That is what permits in England our extraordinary tolerance of national decay, of muddling through, our socializing conservatism and our conservative socialism. Our society and its actual state is nothing, merely the dead real world, not the living imaginary one. And that is why we have evolved a language that always means more than it says, both emotionally and imaginatively. With the Americans it is the reverse. They mean and feel far less than they have the habit of saying. In both cases it is to the same end, to find a place to be free. The outward cynics may live in the States, but the fundamental ones, the true quietists, live in Britain. I am trying to exculpate myself, not to explain cultures. My attitude to nature, my past, Thorncombe, must be partly a product of my own history and genetic makeup, but it is also because I am English. That's John Fowles speaking in the novel Daniel Martin.
Amazing grace, how sweet the sound.
Following on where we left off last time, in the manual for teachers from the Course in Miracles, I would like now to read from chapter 3, What Are the Levels of Teaching? And please remember that the teachers of God, from a Course perspective, refers to anyone who has responded to the inner call of choosing not to see their own interests as apart from someone else's. The teachers of God have no set teaching level. Each teaching-learning situation involves a different relationship at the beginning, although the ultimate goal is always the same, to make of the relationship a holy relationship, in which both can look upon the Son of God as sinless. There is no one from whom a teacher of God cannot learn, so there is no one whom he cannot teach. However, from a practical point of view, he cannot meet everyone, nor can everyone find him. Therefore, the plan includes very specific contacts to be made for each teacher of God. There are no accidents in salvation. Those who are to meet will meet, because together they have the potential for a holy relationship. They are ready for each other. The simplest level of teaching appears to be quite superficial. It consists of what seem to be very casual encounters, a chance meeting of two apparent strangers in an elevator, a child who is not looking where he is going, running into an adult, two students happening to walk home together. These are not chance encounters. Each of them has the potential for becoming a teaching-learning situation. Perhaps the seeming strangers in the elevator will smile to one another. Perhaps the adult will not scold the child for bumping into him. Perhaps the students will become friends. Even at the level of the most casual encounter, it is possible for two people to lose sight of separate interests, if only for a moment. That moment will be enough. Salvation has come. It is difficult to understand that levels of teaching the universal course is a concept as meaningless in reality as in time. The illusion of one permits the illusion of the other. In time, the teacher of God seems to begin to change his mind about the world with a single decision, and then learns more and more about the new direction as he teaches it. We have covered the illusion of time already, but the illusion of levels of teaching seems to be something different. Perhaps the best way to demonstrate that these levels cannot exist is simply to say that any level of the teaching, learning situation is part of God's plan for atonement, and his plan can have no levels, being a reflection of his will. Salvation is always ready and always there. God's teachers work at different levels, but the result is always the same. Each teaching-learning situation is maximal in the sense that each person involved will learn the most that he can from the other. In this sense, and in this sense only, we can speak of levels of teaching. Using the term in this way, the second level of teaching is a more sustained relationship in which, for a time, two people enter into a fairly intense teaching-learning situation and then appear to separate. As with the first level, these meetings are not accidental, nor is what appears to be the end of the relationship a real end. Again, each has learned the most he can at the time. Yet all who meet will someday meet again, for it is the destiny of all relationships to become holy. God is not mistaken in his Son. The third level of teaching occurs in relationships which, once they are formed, are lifelong. These are teaching-learning situations in which each person is given a chosen learning partner who presents him with unlimited opportunities for learning. These relationships are generally few because their existence implies that those involved have reached a stage simultaneously in which the teaching-learning balance is actually perfect. This does not mean that they necessarily recognize this. In fact, they generally do not. They may even be quite hostile to each other for some time, and perhaps for life. Yet should they decide to learn it, the perfect lesson is before them and can be learned. And if they decide to learn that lesson, they become the saviors of the teachers who falter and may even seem to fail. No teacher of God can fail to find the help he needs.
Jatan Jatan Vata
बता दे कैसे दिन कटी है बता
जतन
I'm
That's a track called Ab Kesi Din Katayan by Vidya Rao from the Kabir Project. And that's from a Kabir poem which is translated as, "Tell me away, my love, how shall I pass these days? Make a paper of my torn sari, etch your face in my heart, my love. This side flows the Ganga, on the other, Jamuna. Make me a hut midstream, my love." Says Kabir, "Listen, seekers, take my arm, show me the way, my love." I'm going to read a little bit from the liner notes of that CD. Possibly the most quoted poet-saint of northern India is Kabir, the illiterate mystic who lived between 1398 and 1448 and grew up in a family of Muslim weavers in the city of Varanasi. Kabir was a Naguni, one who believes in a formless divinity that can be discovered within us as well as in every fragment of the universe. His poetry scorns outward scriptures, structures, rituals, and displays of religiosity and piety with a trenchant wit, exhorting his listeners to seek the divine through self-interrogation, to recognize the impermanence of all manifest reality, to taste this experience of shunya, or emptiness, through a vigilant self-awareness and alertness. A spiritual seeker, sharp social critic, hero of low-caste sensibilities, and an icon of speaking truth to power, Kabir is well recognized for this sharp and self-assured poetic voice. But then there is another, more vulnerable Kabir, one who speaks in the voice of a lovelorn woman, envisioning the divine as the beloved from whom we are all separated. I'm going to end today's program with reading from the preface from the Course. Christ's vision is the Holy Spirit's gift, God's alternative to the illusion of separation and to the belief in the reality of sin, guilt, and death. It is the one correction for all errors of perception, the reconciliation of the seeming opposites on which this world is based. Its kindly light shows all things from another point of view, reflecting the thought system that arises from knowledge and making return to God not only possible, but inevitable. What was regarded as injustices done to one by someone else now becomes a call for help and for union. Sin, sickness, and attack are seen as misperceptions, calling for remedy through gentleness and love. Defenses are laid down because where there is no attack, there is no need for them. Our brother's needs become our own because they are taking the journey with us as we go to God. Without us, they would lose their way. Without them, we could never find our own. Forgiveness is unknown in heaven, where the need for it would be inconceivable. However, in this world, forgiveness is a necessary correction for all the mistakes that we have made. To offer forgiveness is the only way for us to have it, for it reflects the law of heaven that giving and receiving are the same. Heaven is the natural state of all the sons of God as He created them. Such is their reality forever. It has not changed because it has not been forgotten. Forgiveness is the means by which we will remember. Through forgiveness, the thinking of the world is reversed. The forgiven world becomes the gate of heaven, because by its mercy, we can at last forgive ourselves. Holding no one prisoner to guilt, we become free. Acknowledging Christ in all our brothers, we recognize His presence in ourselves. Forgetting all our misperceptions, and with nothing from the past to hold us back, we can remember God. Beyond this learning we cannot go. When we are ready, God Himself will take the final step in our return to him.